Hi, Peter Williams here. Are you on the RCR mailing list? Never miss a beat of the news and hard-hitting stories you've come to know and love. Stay in the loop. Visit realitycheck.radio/email or hit the join email button on your RCR app.
Welcome back to the weekly roundup on the Dialogue with Dewa DeBoer and William McGimsey on Reality Check Radio. And I've been asking listeners if we should rename this segment, seeing that it's now at the beginning of the week instead of the end of the week. And I did get a good suggestion to call it the RCR Retrospect. Perhaps we'll work on that a little bit. It might work. Let me know if you think it's a good name. We might play on that a little bit before we settle on something. For now, we'll just stick with Weekly Roundup, but we are definitely renaming it. And as always, William is joining me. Welcome back to the show, William, and I hope you've had a good week.
I have. Thanks for having me back, Dewa. It's good to be here as always.
We actually got to catch up in real life. I think it was the first time that you and I met last week, and you were the first guest on the Dialogue all the way back in February. And for the last few months, you've been doing this weekly segment with me. So it was just a pleasure to meet you in real life.
Was I like a lot of celebrities and shorter than you had imagined?
No. You were about the height I imagined. The good news, though, is you were worried that, do I look good in person, that kind of situation. Well, because of the quality of the videos on these calls, that you actually did look better in person. Your HD, which, that's always a good thing. So you're off the hook on that.
Well, thank you very much.
All right. Well, with the introductions out of the way, the Trump assassination is the first thing that we're going to talk about. The second attempted assassination of former President Donald Trump happened last Monday, and it's been a week now, and it's time to talk about these developments that have come from it, because it's sort of been shrugged off, especially by the mainstream media, by left-wing commentators. The Republican presidential candidate has had an attempted assassination 2 months apart, second one. And that should be incredibly concerning. It should be incredibly outrageous. And yet it is basically just seen as business as usual, which is a very troubling development, I would think.
Yes. There are double standards here in the way the mainstream media treat political violence and incitement to political violence. When political violence is committed against, a Democratic or left-wing political candidate, the mainstream media come on and they call for calm and a lowering of the rhetorical tensions, and we don't want any more violence, that sort of thing. But when it happens the other way around, and in these cases, when it's happening to Donald Trump, it's almost as if they're blaming Trump himself for bringing the assassination attempts on himself. It's his own rhetoric is causing it, they seem to be implying, because this assassination attempt was preceded by, a few weeks of talking about the Haitian migrants in Springfield, Ohio, which is sort of a controversial story. They've been eating pets and, getting on the wrong side of the locals. And this story really rubs liberal sensibilities the wrong way, because it points out that not all people are equal. Different groups of people behave very differently. And it sort of, it undercuts the liberal idea of equality. And it shows that if you are going to act as if all these different peoples from all around the world are equal and allow them to immigrate into your country, that's really going to end up hurting some of the local communities. Because when you have these big differences in behavior and big differences in how familiar people are and living in modern first world societies, it really harms the communities that these people come into. They don't know how to behave. They don't know how to act. They're a big drain on the public services. They take some of the spots in the housing and the hospital services and other services from the locals. When you have a huge number of them coming in, like 20,000 into a 60,000 population town like Springfield, Ohio, it causes huge disruption. So anyway, all that stuff's happening. The locals are complaining about it. And as J.D. Vance put it, the Trump campaign is surfacing those complaints they're getting from their constituents. And the Democrats and the mainstream media really don't like this, because it sort of shows up their liberal idea of, you know, all people being equal or interchangeable or the same to be not so and to be damaging and harmful when implemented.
Well, it's often referred to as the, or mockingly referred to as the magic dirt theory, where if you take someone and put them on American soil, then the magic soil, the magic dirt turns them into Americans and they suddenly will behave just like an American. And well, pretty obviously, that's not the case.
Yeah, well, these people are committed to a sort of utopian, multicultural project. And if you point out that there are real harms that occur to the existing community of bringing in people who are too different or not used to living in first world societies or whatever it is the case may be, then it undermines their project. And rather than treating this as a legitimate problem or a legitimate issue for public debate, they're trying to shut it down. And they're trying to shut it down by, first of all, now incorrectly fact-checking it. They're trying to shut it down by demonizing the people who bring it up as sort of racist. Some people are phoning in bomb threats. There's about 33 bomb threats phoned into Springfield. And then the mainstream media acted as if the Trump campaign was responsible for the bomb threats. They had precipitated them by talking about the issue. And then they used that fact to try and shut down conversation or intimidate them, scare them out of talking about the issue. It's later come to be shown that those bomb threats were hoaxes and that the American media has basically been complicit in laundering, as J.D. Vance put it, laundering foreign misinformation into the U.S. election campaign in order to intimidate and shut down the conversation on this issue, because it was making a big difference in the campaign. It had propelled immigration back to the being the top issue in the campaign. And, a lot of people don't like that. So there's this double standard.
Those hoaxes originated overseas as well. That's what we mean by
laundering foreign misinformation through the media system. So this is a double standard, right? The media think they're allowed to sort of jack up the tensions as much as they want and incite as much violence as they want. And that's what we saw when they incited the riots after the George Floyd murder and the Black Lives Matter riots that happened for a long time after that. By covering that issue the way they did and blaming the white officer, they basically incited a whole bunch of violence. And they're never held responsible for behaving in that way, but they seek to hold other people responsible when they say things that they don't like. And in reality, this is kind of a legitimate political issue. Immigration is probably the major political issue of our time. And people are trying to break the issue gently using these sort of funny memes and stuff like that, because they're in many cases are scared to address it head on. This is the reason that comedians are normally the last line of defense in a liberal democracy, because they try and break stories through humor and bring people's attention to it that way. It's sort of the last line of defense when, you know, just being honest about the problem is banned and can get you put in jail. So that's why people do things this way. So we have to treat things fairly. If it's incitement to violence when one side does it, it should be treated as incitement to violence when the other side does it as well. And it's not. There's a terrible double standard here.
And going back to the attempted assassination and the shooter, the second one, there's, even after a week, very little information about him. He seems to have been connected to Ukraine in some way, recruiting for the Ukraine war. And then sort of everything got pushed down the memory hole, just like with the previous one. Even 2 months later, very little known about these people. It seems like they were, as you say, radicalized by the media. They were pushed to violence by false reporting, misinformation, outright lies, hoaxes that are perpetuated by the media against Trump. And then the media then instantly becomes complicit in burying these attempted assassinations.
Yeah, and just to be clear here, I'm not calling for censorship. I'm not calling for what the media is doing to be banned. You do need to be able to speak about political issues. But freedom can be misused, and you can incite violence by the way you speak about things. And they do it deliberately, and they have done it deliberately in many cases, and they're doing it deliberately here as well. So what I think needs to happen is there needs to be a sort of balance of power in media. And they need to be held to account by other media organizations, by them calling it out, like I'm trying to do here, and hopefully other people have done, like Vice Presidential candidate J.D. Vance has done, like President Trump himself has done. They need to call that sort of behavior to account, let the public know it's happening. And then hopefully that can impose sort of penalties and you know, driving negative coverage of the media. And perhaps some people will switch off and it will harm them in that way, so they can make a decision not to do it. I don't think the answer here is censorship, though, because I think, you know, this is a complex issue. You can incite people to violence with your free speech, but I think censoring things can also incite people to violence as well, because it takes away what's free speech scholars call a release valve. Your ability to talk about the problems often allows you to sort of blow off steam and get it out of your system that way, rather than being forced to say nothing and then it festers and violence is the only way you've got to sort of relieve the tension.
Yeah, exactly. Removing political options from people basically is a form of legitimizing violence, because then it becomes the only way they can be heard, only way they can make a difference, essentially. Yeah. Censorship leads to that kind of outcome.
So I just wanted to be clear, I'm not calling for censorship, but I do think it's a complex issue where speech can be misused to promote violence. And I think in this case, that's what the mainstream media is doing. And it has resulted in two assassination attempts now. So there needs to be some sort of realizing that that's what's happening and holding it to account.
That's right. Because they're, like you said, they know what they're doing. And it's up to us to make sure they don't get away with it. One final point on Trump, then, I should make as well, related to RCR and the dialogue in particular. Trump mentioned remigration in a recent post on social media. It's the first time that he's used the term remigration. And the first time that I really heard about it was in February when I interviewed Martin Sellner. He was one of the advocates of this concept of remigration, which is effectively creating incentives and pathways for returning migrants to their countries of origin. And Trump is using it here in this term to refer to removing illegal immigrants, which is usually done in a more forceful way, in the same way that you would remove people who have committed crimes, immigrants who may have committed crimes and they get deported. But that's part of the broader discussion on remigration is taking root in Europe. It originated in France. The Swedish government, which is a more left-wing government, is officially undertaking various remigration policies, even paying up to think $30,000 to $40,000 to encourage, say, beneficiary-dependent migrants to go home, which would save them hundreds of thousands or even millions of dollars over the course of a lifetime. So this is a big change. I mean, a big win, really, for the people who have been advocating for this concept in the last 5 years, especially. As you said, immigration has become the big issue of our time, and that seems to be developing at a very, very rapid pace.
Yes. So I think there's a growing realization, and I mean, I don't know exactly the numbers, but you'd have to think it's something approaching a majority of the population at this point realizes that immigration policies in previous decades have been a mistake and have caused serious harm to societies. Now, there needs to be some way of reversing bad policies, and remigration would be that way. Now, the people who are against remigration will try and convince you that it necessarily involves human rights violations and these sorts of things, cruel treatment of people. And that isn't true. People who move into a country are more likely to move again. People who come for work, they don't have deep roots in the country they moved to. And if they want work, they're likely to be willing to move again to a new country for work, or a new country that has better conditions, better welfare, and so on and so forth. So if you're willing to move, all it takes is a sort of changing of the incentives that keep you there or are likely to propel you to somewhere else in order to encourage over time proportions of these people to move away, perhaps move back home or perhaps go somewhere else. And these policies have been put in place in some places now, like Sweden, we've talked about. And other places as well, I think, are starting to bring some of these in. And it's, yeah, like you say, it's that now one of the main talking points in the US election, which is, you know, probably the biggest news story in the world. So I think that this is an idea whose time has come, I think. And I think we're going to see more and more countries follow Sweden's lead and implement some of these types of approaches to encourage and incentivize people to move away, since it's been a mistake for many of them to have been allowed to move in the first place.
And after having done this show for nearly a year, I can also say, hey, I've interviewed someone from Sweden, Marcus Follin, the Golden One, and we actually talk about this issue as well and how that's developed in Sweden, the political situation there, how the left wing has embraced it as well. So if that sounds interesting to you, go and have a listen to that later on and search for it in the replays. Very interesting situation. Let's move on now to some other parts of the world, and we'll move our way over to Australia. But first, in a minute, two very small countries that have maybe got some positive news worth mentioning when it comes to budget deficits or running balanced budgets, since that's often a right-wing talking point. Can we balance the budget? And the New Zealand government is doing a terrible job there. But Nayib Bukele, the president of El Salvador, has run the first balanced budget there in decades. And he's been president there now for, I think, five or six years now, and slowly been fixing crime and turning the social conditions in his country around and stabilizing the economy. And he is running, for the first time, a balanced budget. In a similar vein in Argentina, Javier Milei is also trying to push for a balanced budget. It hasn't been passed yet, but it's something that he's insisted, no deficits. And that kind of thinking, often associated with libertarians, is making its way into Australia even. The local elections there, the council, saw a massive victory for the Libertarian Party, formerly known as the Liberal Democrats. And they had one councillor there, or one MP in New South Wales, I think, but they picked up 16 council seats on the preliminary results. It'll be a few weeks before we get the full results. And some of it's been attributed to the Liberal Party not filling all of their candidates, making a mistake and not filing all of the candidates. The Libertarians picking up 16 council seats, but they've been campaigning on an actual right-wing platform. The Libertarians in New South Wales have been copying Javier Milei, saying that they are going to take a chainsaw to regulations, make it easier to build, bring down house prices. They're going to stop all of this woke nonsense, the far-left extremists who are, you know, pushing all kinds of degeneracy. You've actually got these right-wing Libertarians pushing back against it. And that seems to be quite a positive development in New South Wales. And you know, Argentina and El Salvador. And what have you got any thoughts on, you know, how, I guess, this is a great chain of events where you've got young people again turning to the right, being sick of wokeness, sick of a climate agenda, sick of what has previously been a very left-wing trend?
Well, on Bukele, is that how you say his name?
Bukele, yeah. That's at least how I say it.
So he's, well, let's go with that. He's sort of putting Western liberal democratic governments to shame, isn't he? So first of all, he locks up all the criminals, all the gang leaders, and reduces the crime. So, I mean, his country had one of the highest crime rates in the world, and he's put it down to now it's one of the safest ones. So
yes, he's second in the Western Hemisphere, second safest.
Yeah, so I mean, that just shows the very simple policy of applying the law and locking the criminals up in jail works. And now he's done something else that Western liberal democratic regimes can't do either, and that's balance the budget. So, I mean, I think all power to him. I mean, he's doing a good job. That's exactly the type of thing that you want your government to do, responsible governance.
No, but he's an authoritarian. The media is saying that he's an authoritarian, which seems to mean someone who uses their rightful political authority to actually deliver for their voters. I mean, that's really the point we've got to, isn't it? That if you deliver for your voters, you're an authoritarian.
Well, what I would say, I mean, if you're against authoritarianism and you're a Western liberal democratic leader, you better pull your finger out and make sure you're outperforming the authoritarian leaders, because at the moment you're not.
That's right. And even non-democratic countries actually rely a lot on public opinion, you know, because otherwise you get social unrest and like even the dictator will be toppled if his people don't like him. But it seems like liberal democracies have sort of insulated themselves from any consequences, insulated themselves from negative public opinion, and can just kind of keep ignoring the voters, and then the voters will vote for the other side and still get the same results. Like we've created this system that basically a democracy that makes a mockery of the will of the people, the rule.
Yeah, that's because supposed to be. Western liberal democracies have developed these very sophisticated media systems for like controlling and corralling public opinion so that it conforms with the wishes of the elites within Western liberal democracies. So that's not really that democratic at all. You're always going to have a sort of bell curve with even in liberal democratic societies where more people have, where some people have more power than others. So I'm not advocating against that, but it does seem that we've kind of got a wee bit out of whack where the leadership caste or the more powerful people in Western liberal democratic societies have gotten out of whack with the majority opinions of most of the population. And that's creating huge problems, and that's actually spurring the rise of populism within those countries. And of course, you know, and then there's a backlash from the elites against the populists as well, calling them, you know, illiberal and all these sorts of things. But perhaps the elites are being undemocratic and they're not respecting the will of the people they're supposed to be working for. So this giant media mind control Orwellian mechanism that's been erected in Western democracies kind of makes a mockery of democracy in a way, and I think that's a big problem.
And I've got one other bit of good news for the listeners. In the New South Wales local elections as well, Councillor Steve Christou in Cumberland was re-elected as one of the Sydney councils, and I interviewed him a few months ago now, and Steve was one of the councillors who got a drag queen story hour book and various other degenerate material removed from a local library, and he campaigned very heavily against woke issues, and he managed to win re-election. So that's always good news to see. Again, people who are willing to stand by their principles, who are willing to push back against the left, picking up seats or holding on to their seats. And I just saw him say today that the Labour Party has been very damaged, and some of their safer seats have become marginal seats that they're at risk of losing. So that means that your independents, who are right-wing, these right-wing libertarians as well, just be able to bring in victories in Australia. And we can hope that something similar could happen in New Zealand next year if we keep the pressure on, because we see it's working for them. It means it can be done for us as well.
Yeah, well, let's hope so.
And I'll let you talk for a little bit about Australia now as well, because there are two other very important things. Australia has a misinformation bill before Parliament and several developments on their hate speech legislation. So if you'd like to follow up on the local issues there, you can, but otherwise feel free to tell us about what's happened with the misinformation bill. And I think it's a very funny story, actually. What's some of the stuff that's included in there? I say funny, I mean funny in a really bad way.
Well, yeah, I mean, a couple of very serious threats to free speech, legislative threats to free speech coming down the pipe in Australia.
And that's at the federal level, of course, which has got a very left-wing government, whereas it seems like at least at the local level in New South Wales, they're turning more towards the right.
Yeah. So one would be the introduction of this mis- and disinformation bill. What they're proposing to do is fine social media companies very large amounts, up to 5% of their profit levels, for putting information on there that someone somewhere is going to define as a mis- or disinformation. And that would be the Australian Communications and Media Authority, I think, ACMA. I may have got that quite a little bit wrong. I think that's right, though. And so the model is based on what Australia's eSafety Commissioner is doing right now. But basically, the fines are supposed to make the social media companies themselves crack down on and eliminate the mis- and disinformation. So this is obviously a really bad thing, that the whole notion of mis- and disinformation is bunk, right? It doesn't make sense because it assumes that there is a sort of a bank of universally accepted truth, and then deviations from that can be reliably identified as mis- and disinformation, and then they can be censored. But we know in practice that there are lots of different opinions, and that truth is a contested concept. And people have different perspectives. They come from different, you know, religious and ideological, philosophical perspectives. And they can see different things as true or false legitimately from within those frameworks. And so the idea that you're going to reliably identify things as mis- and disinformation is really, what's really going to happen is that they're going to be going after opinions that the government doesn't like, basically. They're going to dress it up as being protecting the truth, but really it's about protect, you know, going after narratives that the government doesn't like. and taking them down. So that's the mis and disinformation bill. The second one would be a reworked hate speech bill. So they've increased the fines there to make quite serious penalties, and they've introduced a broad range of protected minority groups, which if you say something bad about or disagree with, it would count as a hate speech, and you could be fined a lot of money or go to prison. So again, the problem here is subjectivity, right? So a good example here is, what one person thinks of as hate speech can be a legitimate expression of someone else's moral or cultural or religious views. And a good example here is the battle between anti-Semitic and Islamophobic views. And we saw this in New Zealand with the pro-Palestine protests and then the pro-Israeli factions objecting to that. So Chloe Swarbrick, for example, said, you know, from the river to the sea, you know, whatever shall be free, Palestine shall be free. And to, you know, to the Palestine people, this is a slogan for Palestinian freedom. And to the to the Israeli side, it's a slogan of Israeli genocide or genocide against the Jews, because they would lose their country and they'd be, you know, they would no longer have the government to protect them, and they'd be killed by the surrounding Palestinian population who wants them out of there. So how are you going to adjudicate on whether that's hateful or not? I mean, is it hateful to ban it, or is it hateful to allow it? And then is it hateful to advocate for banning it, or is it hateful to advocate for allowing it? And on it goes. There's no real way to answer that objectively. There's just different perspectives. And this is just one example, but many of these so-called hate speech proposals, they fall into those problems. And the overall effect of this is just a chill speech on anything controversial. So no one will say much of anything that's controversial and therefore interesting or important, or that could perhaps lead to different or new understandings, or, you know, cross-cultural improvements in relations, because you just, no one will bother discussing these things for fear of punishment.
Thank you for that quick rundown there. And I was just going to read out this section from the misinformation bill just to give the listeners a very clear example of the kinds of things that the government is planning to ban. While I was just about to read this out, it reminded me of two key issues that the Libertarian councillors did really well on. There's two very important things that the RCR audiences will be interested in. They campaigned very heavily against lockdowns. They're very anti-lockdown, and they're very much against smart cities as well. So there's the monitoring, surveillance of CO2, and, you know, trying to reduce the amount of CO2 that people are allowed to emit within cities using technology and surveillance. So they campaigned very heavily against both of those things, which are both things that RCR is very active on. And part of the bill that they have on misinformation is basically going to make that potentially illegal. So one of the things listed in the Combating Misinformation and Disinformation Bill is causing serious harm to public health in Australia, including to the efficacy of preventative health measures in Australia. So basically, if you were to, say, run a campaign against mRNA vaccines for COVID, then you could be prosecuted under Australian law simply for opposing that. Or you were to oppose lockdowns, you could be jailed for opposing lockdowns. You know, simply like spreading information opposing lockdowns. You know, I'm not talking about, say, breaking lockdown protocols. Actually, posting online against lockdowns could get you jailed in Australia there. Then they also have the vilification of a group distinguished by race, religion, sex, sexual orientation, gender identity, intersex status, disability, nationality, or national or ethnic origin. So presumably if you make share memes about Haitians eating cats, you potentially end up in prison under Australian law, again, if this passes. That's how crazy this is. And then the final one that's worth reading out here is causing imminent harm to the Australian economy, including harm to public confidence in the banking system or financial markets. So the joke from economists was that forecasting a recession would become illegal, perhaps promoting Bitcoin or cryptocurrency, telling people to buy gold, warning them that fractional reserve banking is harmful, the banks are basically anything like that could end up falling under serious harm that has, quote unquote, significant and far-reaching consequences for the Australian community and so on. So very, very vague legislation with a definition of serious harm, which could mean that just about anyone posting anything online from a slightly anti-establishment perspective could get prosecuted, or at least you'd be afraid to post it because you're afraid you might get prosecuted. So you'd have this chilling effect. Then you'd have the level on top of that when it comes to investigation, because you might be investigated, someone will make a complaint, even if you're let off, the process is the punishment. And then at that third level, you'd actually end up in prison for sharing memes, forecasting recessions, or opposing lockdowns. Just completely insane, very, very, very dangerous legislation that the Australian Labor Party is putting forward.
Well, all this stuff is about preventing harm. Right. And right at the beginning of the American founding, there was a guy called Benjamin Franklin, and he said, those who would give up essential liberty for a little safety deserve neither liberty nor safety. Right. So a big part of modern Anglo, particularly Western culture, is this very high value that we place on liberty and liberty over safety. So in some ways, this safety centric culture that is attempting to be imposed on us by these hate speech laws, these mis and disinformation laws, is really an attack on one of the central tenets of our culture, namely liberty. Modern Western, particularly Anglo countries, are founded on an idea of liberty, and that idea is under attack.
Well put, yes. And we are doing all that we can to oppose it. And certainly we would encourage you to keep speaking out for freedom, and we will be able to preserve our heritage. We'll be able to preserve our freedoms. If we do that, we can definitely win. Now, moving on to a different part of the world before we get to a few New Zealand issues, but we definitely have a lot of fun international issues here. Matt Walsh released a documentary last week called Am I Racist? And you may have heard of this documentary, if not, but I'll let William give you a brief description of what this documentary is about and why it's causing such an uproar.
I haven't watched the documentary.
It's only in cinemas in America, so you can't actually watch it here. So don't worry, no one in New Zealand has officially seen it.
But what's important here is that Matt Walsh and the other guys, and I think Daily Wire is the other he's at, that they're doing very effective culture war, you know, stuff, and it's professionally done from a conservative perspective. So this movie is a follow-up to his previous one called What is a Woman, where he went around and he interviewed these transgender
trans activists and surgeons.
Yeah, trans activists, you know, the people who think you can switch from men to women and you have the surgeries and you take the hormones, and the people who promote all that stuff. The gender identity is all socially constructed, and mm-hmm. you're a bigot if you think it's the doctor can tell when he looks at the baby which one it is. So anyway, he went around and he interviewed all these people, and when these people get to control the way that they're presented, they're able to make it sound, you know, sophisticated and intellectual, and, you know, you're just a bigot and you're stupid if you don't understand it. But when people who are on our side control the camera, you know, and we can film these people, what you see about them is that really they're just kind of dicks and they don't know what they're talking about. And they believe a bunch of rubbish and they can't justify it. And that's what the What is a Woman movie is. He asked a very simple question. He went and he talked to these people and he said, are you a woman? Are you not? And then they would say, if he was a man who thought he was a woman, then he would say, well, what is a woman then? And no one could define what a woman is. And that was the joke of the program. And now he's doing the same thing with Am I Racist? So, I mean, obviously everyone's going to tell him that he is racist. But what he's going to show is that these people just believe everything is racist, right? And that's the thing about woke people. Everything is racist. If you do it this way, you're a racist. It's a catch-22. If you try and do it this way, you're a racist too. There's no way of not being a racist. If you're a white person, you're racist as soon as you get up. You're racist when you eat your dinner. You're racist when you go to bed again. And you get up in the morning, you try your best not to be a racist, but it's all futile because you're going to be a racist no matter what you do.
Mm-hmm. Which makes you just wonder why these people get so upset about racism, because, you know, they're always running around calling everybody racist, but they're also racist. So why should anyone care?
No one should care. And that's the point that I think that we're getting to. And that's what I think is going to come out of this movie. The people are just going to stop caring because they're going to realize that, you know, these people are silly. They believe silly things. They're calling everyone a racist, and they just do it to try and get their way. It's not really about reason or truth or trying to make the world a better place. It's trying to win arguments with like the magic word that they can cast like a spell to get what they want and make the other guy look bad.
That's exactly what it is. Yeah. The trailer for it is out, and there's a few clips out as well. I definitely would recommend people watch those. There's a good bit that they released beforehand about, forget the lady's name, D'Angelo is her last name. I can't remember what her first name is.
Is it Robin D'Angelo?
Robin, that's right. Robin D'Angelo. She wrote a book called White Fragility. That's, I think, the book, White Fragility. And anyway, they interview her, and they actually paid her money to interview her. I think that's how they she got roped in, because she couldn't resist the money. And then they get her to pay reparations to the producer, because he's got a black producer. And they got this all on camera, and because he's talking about, you know, racism, and, well, I'm racist, you're racist, yeah, we're all racist, you know, we need to pay reparations, yeah, you should pay, you know, I need to pay reparations, you need to pay reparations, yeah, that's great. And so she actually gets money out of her wallet and gives it to Matt Walsh's producer to pay reparations to him. So that's how insane these people are.
Yep, I can't wait to watch it now.
Yeah, absolutely. And according to Matt Walsh, that's not even the most shocking thing. Apparently, that was one of the funniest things, but apparently there are some very disturbing scenes in here, which you said around sociology and what he's able to talk some of these people into doing, because they all believe that they're racist. So he starts to be like, well, what if we did this, and kind of basically literally flagellate themselves, kind of. I don't think it goes quite that far, but, you know, it's almost to that point where, if you know, the story of the medieval monks who would go and flagellate themselves for their sins, he basically got them to like do a replay of that. Like, that's how, and I, you know, with a monk flagellating himself for his sins makes a little bit more sense, but, you know, when it comes to, you know, the sins of your ancestors, then it starts to get a little bit more silly, I think.
Yeah, well, that's interesting that you bring that up, because you do feel with a lot of this work stuff that there's a lot of misplaced religious impulse behind it, that they that might be some of the, you know, the emotional momentum, or the emotions behind it are pushing them into it. Is what ought to be directed towards religion or towards God is being directed in these sort of funny and unproductive directions, because they don't have anything genuine to direct that psychological impulse towards.
I can't remember the source of this quote now, but it was something along the lines of, when people stop worshiping God, or they don't believe in nothing, but they'll believe anything, kind of. Yeah. Like, oh, if they're just not worshiping God, they'll worship anything, you know, any of this bizarre made up, like just the complete most insane thing you can think of, which is like Matt Walsh goes over in his I Am Racist documentary. Certainly, like I said, I haven't seen it. There's a whole lot more to it than what we've just discussed. This is just the previews that they've released. Unfortunately, you're not going to find it in a New Zealand theater, but it will be available at some point to New Zealanders, and we'll bring it up again briefly when that's the case. Definitely just keep your eye on it. Now, one final international issue, perhaps we'll just go over this very, very briefly, because it's sort of developing as this is over in the Middle East. Things are always developing in the Middle East, never stable. But last week, Israel managed to commit the highest tech assassination to date, where they planted basically explosives inside the batteries of pagers that were sold to Hezbollah, and they set off hundreds or thousands, perhaps, of these pagers, bombs that blew up all across Lebanon and Syria, and they killed a few dozen and wounded thousands of people with these bombs. You also had the Houthis hit Israel with a ballistic missile, which is the first time that's happened. And even a New Zealand connection has been raised as well. Various concerns have been called by spy watchdog, saying that it's possible that New Zealand intelligence agencies are actually, you know, through Five Eyes involved in providing intelligence to Israel, and so on. So it's currently a very volatile situation, but what are your initial reactions, I guess, to the technology that's being deployed here in terms of concerns perhaps that people might now have around exploding phones? And because you're basically, you know, carrying a bomb around in your pocket if someone injects some Semtex into it.
Well, what an effective operation that Israel, presumably Israeli's intelligence agencies, have carried out here. So they've killed about 9 people and injured around 3,000, which is an incredible...
It may have been up to 4,000, but I don't have the exact numbers.
So the reason they were using pagers is that they were worried that they could be tracked by Israel and then have like drone strikes done on them if they used mobile phones. So they switched to pagers to get around that problem, because pagers are sort of, they're less connected to the internet and stuff.
It's like a one-way communication thing as well.
On radio instead. But Israel somehow found out about this and were able to go and talk, I think, to the pager manufacturer in Taiwan. Or maybe they didn't talk to them, I don't know. But somehow they got a hold of the pagers. They put a wee bit of explosive in them. And then they were able to hack into the radio frequency somehow, or the radio transmission, and do something that activated the pages to blow up. So what this means is that, now, first of all, it's the damage they've done to Hezbollah now, that, I mean, they've injured 9 and they've injured around 3,000 or 4,000, you say, so it's a lot of people. But now they've got to be worried about their communications all the time. If they can't use cell phones and they can't use pages, how are they going to communicate and how are they going to coordinate their activities? It's a real problem, and they have to worry. I think that's deliberate, that Israel would go after the communication, because if a group can't communicate, it can't coordinate its activities and it can't do much of anything very effectively as an organization. So very, very clever to go after the communications ability like that.
This raises some interesting questions, I guess, around other groups like the Houthis, which I mentioned, who are able to hit Israel with ballistic missiles. I just saw last week Elon Musk said Starlink is now available in Yemen, which is basically controlled by the Houthis. I'm not sure how they arrange that, but they're using very high-tech stuff. Like the Houthis launched missiles into space, like that basically had the first space war. That was a few months ago, where we had a missile shot down in space the Houthis had launched, and now they're launching ballistic missiles and they have access to Starlink. You know, like, what's going on? And they're able to close shipping to the, you know, through the Red Sea. Seems to be the opposite to Hezbollah, who are like low tech now, who can't even use pagers. They can't use phones, they can't use pagers. And then you've got these other guys over in Yemen who are fighting space wars and launching ballistic missiles and crippling the global economy, the shipping through the Red Sea. Very different, strange kind of situation. And people have also raised questions about Hamas, because obviously last year, the October 7 attacks, I've been reading some of the reports in Israeli newspapers. So don't read Hebrew, can't read the reports, but I have read the English Israeli newspapers and the opposition statements as well. They've actually been raising a lot of questions to Benjamin Netanyahu and the intelligence agencies, because they knew that Hamas was planning the stuff. Obviously, they have access to the communication and so on. And they have video of Benjamin Netanyahu being bored in an intelligence briefing about this stuff. And they're basically, the opposition is accusing Netanyahu of kind of manipulating events for his own political survival, that he's not put the interest of Israel first and not really cared about protecting Israelis, but really wants a deliberate long war so that his own political survival is ensured. If you're sort of reading between the lines of what some of these opposition leaders are saying, I think Yair Lapid, and I think he's the main position leader, and what they're printing in, you know, the Jerusalem Times and Haaretz, seems to be like internally within Israel, they're asking a lot of questions about this, because you've got the fact that they're able to take out the communications of Hezbollah, and then they don't know what's going on in Gaza.
Yeah, well, I mean, I'm not an expert in this area. I read that Hamas have more sophisticated encrypted communications than Hezbollah do, for whatever reason. But yeah, I mean, it's not unreasonable for Benjamin Netanyahu to be concerned about his political survival. I think he's got criminal investigations or something going on into him, so he could end up in jail if his term as prime minister ends. So anyone would be worried about that.
Yeah, it's just very interesting following the domestic situation in Israel, which is, I guess, increasingly unstable at the moment.
a lot of Israelis getting unhappy with the behavior in the war as well. It's not.
Yes, in particular, the fact that the hostages are more often turning up dead than alive now, and there's no deal. Obviously, on the other side of Benjamin Netanyahu's coalition, you have people who think he should be hitting harder, right? So there's no easy way out now. And like I said, this is basically just escalation happening more slowly, I think, than people were expecting. But it is happening. You basically have all this setting up for the next level, the next wave of the war. Because if you're an Israeli in northern Israel, you're being bombarded by rockets from Hezbollah every single day. And you'll be itching for a fight, you know, hoping that the Israeli tanks will be rolling north. So that's kind of setting the scene for the next phase of this, and especially taking out the core part of their leadership, just is a clear indication that nobody's backing down, and will unfortunately basically impossible to make predictions about what's going on in the Middle East, though.
Yeah, well, I won't try.
No, don't do that. Now, I do have a good story. I was going to save the good story for the end, but because it's got something to do with cell phones, I might as well drop it in here now since we're talking about cell phones and communications. But the cell phone ban in New Zealand schools was laughed at and derided by some on the New Zealand left. But I've actually had a good story come out of this just last week. Mount Albert Grammar School has said that for the first time in many years, they have had a rugby ball kicked through a school window. That's because students are actually playing outside. And so they're very happy to see that instead of just sitting around on their phones at lunchtime, the kids are actually talking. They're actually playing together outside, playing rugby, playing soccer and other sports. They're actually paying attention, and they've had to install more handball courts, and they need to put more teachers on supervision because the children actually need supervision because they're not just sitting on their phones the whole time. So just little things like that, not even directly related to learning, but just related to kids interacting, being less socially isolated. And that aspect, I think, was completely ignored in the discussion around the cell phone ban. So there you go. Don't need to be Hezbollah to do without your cell phones. The kids at school are doing much better without their cell phones.
Yeah, well, I mean, that's pleasing. I mean, I've got kids, and anyone who's got kids knows how addictive cell phones and watching videos on the cell phones or on the iPads can be for the kids. So, you know, it is, I think it is good to take them off them from time to time and get them outside and doing some good stuff. And I'm glad to hear that that's working.
Yeah, and a lot of this stuff is designed to be addictive. Basically, like, are you going to give your kids drugs? You know, are you going to give them cocaine? No, you're not. Like, that's basically, you're doing that, but worse when it comes to completely unfettered access to the internet. And you basically had this with school kids in every single school in the country, where it's like just very, very damaging. Speaking of drugs and so on, we could go on to another kind of positive news story, I guess. Tougher sentencing laws have been introduced into Parliament. The National Party did promise this part of their law and order. It doesn't seem like it's going to be as good as Bukele's cleanup in El Salvador, but do you think this is a step in the right direction? Are these sentencing laws that they're introducing actually going to make a difference, or is it going to be just a bit of a show?
I think it's a small step in the right direction. I mean, as we've discussed before, I mean, the crime is committed by a very small proportion of the population, and a lot of the crime is committed by repeat offenders. And if you can lock them up in prison, they're unable to go outside and commit crimes against ordinary people. And as Bukele's program shows, if you lock up large proportions of these people, you can drastically reduce the crime rate. So that approach works. A lot of people don't like it. The academics in particular don't like it. The academics will argue that it doesn't work. The academics are wrong on this. If you put the crooks in jail, they can't commit crime, and you reduce the crime rate. And I think we're getting more and more evidence from around the world that this very simple approach actually works.
Now, one of their complaints from these academics is always, well, you need to focus on making sure that people don't want to commit crimes. Perhaps they're discouraged from committing crimes rather than just making it, you know, impossible by locking them up in jail. Is there something to do with any of these laws here, improvements that are actually going to, say, stop people from becoming criminals in the first place, that are going to discourage criminal activity? whether or not it's related to the tougher sentencing. Perhaps you think that's going to have a difference all on its own in terms of what we've seen with gangs and so on. Because there's also some concerns around free speech when it comes to gangs and patches and so on. So is
The gang patch law, I think, is a different law. But there is a legitimate free speech issue there that it bans the gang insignia. And being able to wear and display your gang insignia is a type of freedom of expression. And when you think about it, many of these gang insignia, like if you take the Black Power fist, for example, I mean, I totally get that people find it intimidating, but in many ways that resembles, civil rights logos of various different types of organizations. If you think of the African-American civil rights movement, what is the difference between the African-American civil rights movement and Black Power? I'm not saying this to impugn anyone. What I'm saying is Black Power is very crude. Black Power does criminal things. But basically, what's going on in Black Power is a desire to band together and stick up for one another and fight for one another's, not quite rights, but, fight for one another in a sense. Mm-hmm. And that ethos is very similar, actually, to what lay behind many civil rights organizations who did so in a much more intellectual and a much more positive way. But the line between what is a gang and what is a civil rights organization is not always clear cut. So I think there's people won't like what I'm saying here, but it's a legitimate issue and there's a legitimate free speech issue in that. I'm not saying I'm not going to take sides, but there's a legitimate free speech issue.
It's fine. I mean, we just saw now 2 weeks ago, 3 weeks ago, the Comancheros in Christchurch. I believe the police had a sting operation where they rounded up like every single member of this gang implicated in crimes and trying to give them all prison sentences. I think that's a positive thing. And it's like, if there are gang members committing crimes, then it should be possible to catch them, right? That seemed to have been a big problem with the previous government, was there no desire to catch criminals.
Well, I actually read in relation to the Comancheros arrest that the fact that they were all wearing their gang insignia or whatever is what made them able to do a mass arrest like that. They were able to easily identify them. So that's meant something for people to think about, Like if they weren't allowed to display their gang insignia, they weren't wearing it, but it would have made it harder to arrest them.
Yeah. And I mean, I've previously suggested that if a gang is really causing a problem, like we have active laws when it comes to terrorist organizations, you can basically cabinet can prescribe a particular organization and the police can just round them all up, which seems like a much simpler solution because they do it anyway. So why not just make use of the existing law? And if the gang is not causing a problem, if they're not committing crimes that you can pin on them, like what's the problem? And obviously gangs are always like the definition of a gang is that it's a criminal organization, basically that it's engaged in drug dealing and so on. So they should be able to arrest them for actually doing those crimes. That would be very, very nice. And perhaps the tougher sentencing laws will make that easier because this is a complaint that you hear a lot from frontline police officers who are actually decent. Some of them are a decreasing number of them because many of them just get frustrated and quit. It's not really good for morale. It's not good for your mental state, not good for your soul if it's the same people that you're rounding up every other week and then the courts just toss them back out. So you put your life on the line, you put yourself in dangerous situations to arrest someone, try and bring them to justice, and then they get to a judge and the judge says, okay, here's your sentence discount of 70%, do 100 hours of community service and off you go, and then they're committing crimes again. So a core part of these new sentencing laws, if they get passed, which they should, will be things like making sure that discounts can't be given more than 40%, will be to make sure that crimes that are committed when someone's already in front of the courts or on parole and so on, that they get much tougher sentencing in those cases. Because that seems to be a really big issue in New Zealand, unfortunately, is like it's the same people just committing crimes over and over again. It's like 500 people that commit the majority of the crimes, like violent crimes, basically. Like that's how bad it is. Obviously, there's other people involved on the peripheries who are involved in creating more criminals, and it would be great to catch those as well, the extended gang networks, because if they're not committing violent crimes, they're selling drugs and pushing people into more violent criminal backgrounds. But at the end of the day, like you've said, as we talked about with Bukele, as people who have studied other, you know, nations in this area, like Singapore. Singapore is a notorious low crime city, in a large part because Lee Kuan Yew basically just, you know, like if you stole three Coke cans from the local dairy, you'd go to prison for 3 years or something, you know, just very, very harsh penalties. And as it turns out, people don't commit crimes when there's things like that at stake.
Yeah. And it's funny, isn't it? Because the academics in New Zealand would always tell you that deterrence doesn't work.
Which we know it works, because all you need to do is look at a country where they have that kind of deterrence, and like, it works, obviously. Anyway, but they'll, no, my statistics say X, Y, Z. Like, okay, just go to one of these countries and you'll know they're lying. Now, final item. Sorry, I haven't saved much time for this, but we'll make a little bit of extra time. We'll squeeze it in. Race-based targets for healthcare have been rolled back. And same thing with targets to hire, I think 8% of public service contracts going to iwi organizations. Those are things that the government has delivered on, because these were promises in their coalition agreements. Do you see this as a positive? I know you do, but what's the overall view? Is there a better way to kind of achieve what the previous government was trying to achieve, which was to say, Maori and Pacific Islanders have worse outcomes when it comes to health care systems, so we need to fix that, or, you know, we want to give more money to iwi organizations and so on, and so we want them to have more contracts. Like, is that an okay thing to do? Is there a better way to do that than what the government was doing, or are you glad that it's all being wiped out?
Yeah, and I think this is a good thing in general. So they've issued a cabinet circular to all public sector agencies saying that they have to deliver services on the basis of not race. Now, you would have thought they would have done that already, given that it's in the coalition agreement and they can read and it's their job to do what the government wants them to do. But apparently they had to issue a separate circular just to make it official.
Yeah, bureaucrats are just terrible, terrible when it comes to that. And they're very ideological, very much opposed to delivering on what their government wants them to deliver on. They're supposed to be servants of the public, but instead they're ideologues.
Yeah. So ACT has a very strong ethos of that people should be treated as individuals.
Pretty equally, yeah.
Equal before the law. And I think in general, that's a good thing. Although I do think you can take it too far. We've talked on the program about how, it's proper and right for a woman to be treated differently from men in certain respects, and to have, you know, women's toilets and women's sports. And it's wrong for it to be treated as discrimination for them to exclude people on the basis of those things. You know, you don't want to allow the trans people into the women's sports, because that can be, it's unfair on the women. And similarly, you know, you don't want to, there are good reasons why in our laws children are treated differently from adults as well. So I just think equality before the law is good, but there are reasonable exceptions for where different, identifiably different groups can be treated differently in certain circumstances. So you don't want to be overly dogmatic, where you're going to end up doing things like, you know, not allowing women's toilets, for example. And, you don't really want to go into those sorts of areas.
Yeah, but what if I've got a very specific example here in the case of, say, the healthcare system, where you see that when it comes to certain diseases, people from certain ethnic groups are statistically much more likely to suffer from those particular diseases or have certain genetic issues. Is there not a place in the healthcare system to kind of be able to target that? Or does the clause to say, well, it's based on need, if you say, well, this has to be based on, does that take into account that the healthcare system should be taking genetic predispositions that certain ethnic groups have to particular diseases into account? We tend to see this with, say, overrepresentation of diseases or outcomes for, heart disease and diabetes and so on in Maori and Pacific communities in particular? Or is the argument it's all about healthy living and it's not really part of their ethnic background?
Well, there's a very deep philosophical conversation there as to whether the government is whether it's appropriate for governments to focus on equalizing outcomes across either individuals or groups at all. And of course, egalitarian people will say that it is appropriate and the government ought to be doing that. But other philosophical perspectives will say it's not. The health system, a public health system does work on an egalitarian basis. It prioritizes people for treatment based on need. And so I think it's reasonable in those cases for people most needing medical treatment to get the medical treatment first. But you can do that without overt ethnic targeting. You can look how badly sick someone is. You can look at, you know, a variety of different indicators based on, factors that aren't related to race or ethnicity that will give you a good indication of how likely someone is to be sick or suffer from various diseases. So I think, you know, there really is no need to be doing that.
Well, that's a very short answer to a very complicated subject. So thank you for that. We are out of time for today. Thank you very much for joining me again, William. And I'll just remind the listeners, you can go to X and find the Zeitgeist, William McGimpsey there. Follow what he's doing. He's got great commentary every week.
Thanks, Dewa.
And to all of the listeners, we will be right back after this break.
Thank you for tuning in to RCR Reality Check Radio. If you like what you're listening to, dislike what you're listening to, either way, we want to hear from you. Get in touch with us now. You can text us with your message to 2057, that's 2057, or email us at inbox@realitycheck.radio. We would love to hear from you, so connect with us today.